This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Susan Jordan, who represented Sarah Jane Olson, recently released from jail, then rearrested.
Sarah Jane Olson, supposedly involved with the SLA, Symbionese Liberation Army, let out of prison and then put back in. A mistake or political persecution?
We'll also hear an excerpt from the recent panel at Left Forum 2008 titled The Arrival of the American Police State, featuring our own Michael Stephen Smith. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
This is 2008. It's been a lot of anniversaries already. We had the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War. We had the 40th anniversary of the My Lai Massacre. And today, actually, this Monday, is the 40th anniversary of another historic moment in America. It was President Johnson's speech telling the world, but particularly the United States, that he was not going to run for another term as president. We'll hear his words, but what he said was, "I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president." Let's have a listen to President Johnson saying he will not run for president.
Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president. But let men everywhere know, however, that a strong and a confident and a vigilant America stands ready tonight to seek an honorable peace and stands ready tonight to defend an honored cause, whatever the price, whatever the burden, whatever the sacrifice that duty may require. Thank you for listening. Good night, and God bless all of you.
People were completely floored. It was in large part because the opposition to the war was at such a fever pitch, and Johnson had just escalated the war day after day, even though he'd come into office on a promise of de-escalation, that it was no longer credible for him to even try and run again. Michael and I, of course, remember this well because we were in our early 20s. Heidi was younger. Jeff was younger. And it was quite a moment, Michael. I'm sure you remember it.
Well, you know, the United States was very radicalized then. And in retrospect, it's no surprise that Johnson stepped down. He had to cool things out. And it wasn't just the United States. It's also the 40th anniversary, not just of huge student uprising and taking over of hundreds of campuses in the United States and big demonstrations that year. But it's also the 40th anniversary of almost revolution in France when de Gaulle, who was the premier, had to leave and go to Belgium. He thought he was finished.
Also 1968, March 31st was the actual date of Johnson's withdrawal. And by the time you hear our next show, it will have also passed the 40th anniversary of the murder of Martin Luther King, which took place on April 4th, 1968, just 4 days. Think about that, just 4 days after Johnson's resignation speech. And at that point, there was urban revolution in, I think, roughly 120 cities across the country. I myself was doing some work for the Legal Defense Fund on school cases in Baltimore, and there were federal troops in the streets. You couldn't leave your hotel, and there were big tanks rolling through downtown Baltimore shortly after April 4th.
I was in Detroit, same situation. Half the city was ablaze. There were helicopters with soldiers with rifles trained on you. The Army took over a school and made it into a camp. We used to say that the Cuban Revolution would take over camps and make them into schools. It was just extraordinary at times of crisis and times of promise. And I think that we may see those kinds of extraordinary times coming again here to the United States.
Just one last note on Johnson. After King's murder, Johnson was pushed to do something more about civil rights and the end of Jim Crow. In the end, all he did was pass, not all, but all he really did was pass a fair housing law shortly afterwards. And he didn't do any more, and he was sort of angry at what he called the urban riots, angry that blacks weren't more thankful for him, and he essentially said he wasn't going to do any more. On the night of April 4th, President Johnson addressed the nation regarding the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King, I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence. I pray that his family can find comfort in the memory of all he tried to do for the land he loved so well. I have just conveyed the sympathy of Ms. Johnson, myself, to his widow, Mrs. King. I know that every American of goodwill joins me in mourning the death of this outstanding leader and in praying for peace and understanding throughout this land. We can achieve nothing by lawlessness and divisiveness among the American people. It's only by joining together and only by working together can we continue to move toward equality and fulfillment for all of our people. I hope that all Americans tonight will search their hearts as they ponder this most tragic incident. I have canceled my plans for the evening. I am postponing my trip to Hawaii until tomorrow. Thank you.
In one of the documents that was published during that period, before he actually did any legislation, he was told that it would be considered a breach of faith by the entire black community and a good deal of the white community unless he started really doing more to dismantle Jim Crow. And what he said, he apparently scribbled angrily on that memo, "I promise nothing. I stated my intentions only, since changed by the riots." So essentially, he is just angry after. He's resigned. King's killed. He's told you have to do more in this country. There's urban revolution, and he says, forget it. I'm not doing anything. I'll do the Fair Housing Act, and that's it.
The one thing he did concentrate his energies on was the steady escalation of the war against the Vietnamese people. That was something that occupied most of his time. He had maps in his office. At the end of the day, they succeeded in killing 3 million Vietnamese and over 50,000 American soldiers. That was the hallmark of his service to this country, and that was the cause of his disgrace.
We'll give you more updates on this historic 40th anniversary of 1968 as we go forward. A lot more has happened, but we just want you to be aware at one point in the 1960s, this country was in ferment. A while ago on Law and Disorder, we brought you Jonathan Heifetz to discuss two important cases that were argued last week in the Supreme Court. It's the Munaf and Omar cases. They're both American citizens, and you probably don't remember, but one of them was a American citizen who had helped some Romanian journalists and was later accused by the Iraqis of being an insurgent or kidnapping them. Likewise with Mr. Munaf, an American citizen. Both of these people, Mr. Munaf and Mr. Omar, are in custody in Iraq, in custody of the United States. And their lawyers, Jonathan Heifetz being one of them, Joe Margulis being another, filed writs of habeas corpus on behalf of these two American citizens. That case was argued last week in the Supreme Court, and it was a very, very difficult, difficult argument. You would think that American citizens being in the custody of U.S. officials in a U.S.-run prison under U.S. military jurisdiction would have the right to file a writ of habeas corpus to test their detention. The Americans, the American generals, want to turn them over to the Iraqi courts. The lawyers are saying, don't turn them over to the Iraqi courts. They could be tortured in the Iraqi courts. The Iraqi courts aren't fair. And of course, this isn't something American officials want to hear because they want to believe that they have democracy in Iraq and Iraqi courts are fair. So the case goes to the Supreme Court. It's argued last week. Difficult argument. The argument of the administration is amazing. And we'll probably end this segment there and then we'll report on the decision when it comes down. It's that there's no habeas here, even though they're American citizens, because these two American citizens are not being held by the Americans. They're being held by the multinational force that is occupying or involved in Iraq right now. As someone said on one of the blogs, yeah, they have a French chef making crepes for the generals. That's the multinational force. Well, at least Justice Breyer was saying, what are you talking about? They're held in an American jail. They're held by American officials, and you're saying that this is somehow we can't get habeas because the custodians are not Americans, but they're a multinational force? So I don't think they'll get far on that. On the other hand, many of the justices were skeptical that in a so-called war zone like Iraq, that there should be any right of habeas corpus. It's related, sadly, to the Guantanamo cases in a manner in which I don't want to fully explain. Of course, these are American citizens. In the Guantanamo cases, we have non-citizens completely outside a war zone in American territory, essentially, for purposes of the lease in Cuba. So we still have a good shot on that case pending in the Supreme Court now on the Guantanamo cases. But this pair of cases are going to be very interesting to follow as we go down the line. Last week, the Supreme Court also came down with, I guess I would call it a real shocker. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, but it has a key provision. What it says is that if you're a foreign citizen in the United States and you're taken into prison, you have an immediate right to consult with someone from your country's consulate, some diplomat or official. It's considered a critical right because it's your only way of trying to get a lawyer who can actually do something for you that might not be a run-of-the-mill lawyer that doesn't really work. Well, Mexico had at one point a few years ago 51 people on death row, many of them in Texas, who had never been given their consular visits by state authorities who were holding them. They were simply railroaded through into the death penalty. Well, there's been a whole series of cases about this. Eventually, a case went to the International Court of Justice at The Hague. The International Court of Justice ruled that the consular provision was violated and that all of the state courts have to reconsider those death penalties and see whether people were given fair trials because they were denied the right to have their consular officials visit them prior to their getting an attorney. What's really shocking about what the Supreme Court did was they said that that treaty, the Vienna Consular Affairs Treaty, and the United Nations treaty or provision that says that decisions of the International Court of Justice at The Hague have to be obeyed by states in the United States or by the United States, does not have to be obeyed. They basically use a fancy legal term called non-self-executing, which I don't have to explain to you, but it's basically BS. Even though you have a binding treaty ratified by the Senate and signed by the president, and you have a UN charter, again, ratified by the Senate and signed by the president, which require its provisions to be obeyed, you now have the Supreme Court saying that, well, the state of Texas can go and execute this Mexican man without actually examining whether the fact that he could not have a consular official visit him might have in some way given him an unfair trial. A completely amazing and disgusting opinion by the Supreme Court. It was done 6-3, three liberals dissenting, if you want to call them that, or three of the more, at least the judges who have some semblance of law left, dissenting in the case. But it just indicates how far down the road this country has gone toward not having any respect for international treaty or law.
Former Symbionese Liberation Army member Sarah Jane Olson was paroled March 17 after serving 6 years in prison. The 60-year-old Juan Olson was rearrested at LA International Airport shortly after her release when officials discovered that they had miscalculated her sentence by 1 year. Olson's attorneys say she should be freed from prison immediately because officials had no authority to rearrest her after she was paroled. The former Kathleen Ann Celaya lived most of her life under the alias Sarah Jane Olson, which she now uses as her legal name. In 2001, she pled guilty to 2 counts of possessing explosives in a bank bombing in the 70s. Immediately after entering the plea, however, she told reporters that she was innocent and that she had decided to take the plea due to the climate after September 11, 2001 attacks, in which she felt an accused bomber could not receive a fair trial from a jury. In her words, "It became clear to me that the incident would have a remarkable effect on the outcome of this trial. The effect was probably going to be negative." Joining us today on Law and Disorder is Susan B. Jordan, criminal defense lawyer and civil litigator and lead attorney on the case of The People of the State of California v. Sarah Jane Olson. Susan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Many of us were surprised and delighted to see that Sarah Jane Olson was recently released and then, lo and behold, rearrested in even more of a surprise when it turned out that state corrections officers had miscalculated or said they had miscalculated her sentence by a year. Now, you represented Sarah Jane Olson.
I represented Sarah Jane Olson when she was arrested again in L.A. in 2002, I think it was. And then I left the case for medical reasons, for illness. But I represented Bill and Emily Harris in the 70s when they were charged with the kidnap of Patty Hearst. So I go way back with all of them.
Wow. For our listeners' background, if they don't know, Sarah Jane Olson, formerly Kathleen Ann Celaya, had actually, until recently, lived most of her life underground after her involvement with the Symbionese Liberation Army.
She was living a life, an open life, in Minnesota with her family. Her husband's a doctor. She has 3 kids. She was very active in community organizations. She was a very well-loved citizen in Minneapolis. And the only thing underground about her was that she had changed her name. There was really a serious question about whether there was any what was outstanding against her, because the case in L.A., the attempted bombing case, became such a big deal, was a non-event. No one really, the case was not developed. It wasn't even clear whether there was a warrant out for her. The big case that the SLA ended up going to jail again on was the bank. They had robbed a bank in 75, and a woman was killed there. That was really what was, and Sarah Jane did not even know that there was a warrant out for her in that case. And there wasn't, because that case was developed again. The case was indicted only after Sarah Jane Olson was arrested.
Who was indicted in that case? I don't remember, Susan.
Bill and Emily. Right, Bill Harris, Emily Harris, Sarah Jane Olson.
And you represented initially Bill and Emily.
Lenny Weinglass represented one of them, and I represented the other. I think Lenny represented Bill, and I represented Emily originally in the original case, which was the kidnap of Patty Hearst case. Later, after the bank robbery case, they did indict the bank robbery case, but they gave it up, and then they re-indicted it 25 years later.
Who went to jail originally for the SLA, and what did they go to jail for?
Bill and Emily went to jail for the kidnap of Patty Hearst.
Right.
And they went to jail, and they did, I think, 6 or 7 years, and then they got out. They got out, and life went by, and life went on, and life went on, and then when Sarah Jane Olson got arrested, when they found her in Minneapolis, arrested her on the L.A. case, then the prosecutor started putting together the bank robbery case all over again. And they decided that they had enough evidence, not new evidence, but they put the case together again differently. And then they recharged Bill and Emily and Sarah Jane Olson.
With the bank robbery at that point.
The bank robbery.
Gotcha.
Bank robbery homicide.
Gotcha. And that's that bank robbery, is that what Sarah Jane pleaded guilty to?
So Sarah Jane pled guilty to 2 things. She pled guilty to the bank robbery and the attempted bombing of a police car.
Right.
And what happened last weekend was this was no mistake on the part of corrections. What happened was that she had been given notice, as I understand it, about 2 months ago, that her date, or about last fall, I think, that her date was whatever it was last week. And it was known, it was no secret, they didn't let her out of jail overnight. You know, it was a calculated date. And there had always been a dispute. California changed its sentencing law. We went from indeterminate sentencing in the 70s to determinate sentencing in the 80s. And the people who fell into the 70s category all had their sentences recomputed. And so when Sarah Jane went to prison on the two guilty pleas, there was a big dispute about how to interpret the old law to transfer it to the new law. And there was this disputed extra year, which is now the year they gave her, which they basically said, no, we're not going to apply the other year. The defense interpretation of the computation is correct. And they notified her lawyers. They notified the judge, actually, in L.A., who sat on this case. The board did, that it did not intend to impose the one-year enhancement that had been challenged by her lawyers. So then she gets out of jail, and somebody raises a big squawk, probably the victims and the correctional officers, and all of a sudden, here's the one-year disputed sentence that had been resolved, had been challenged and had been resolved, was back again.
So that's amazing, because, you know, you read the papers, and the papers made it just look like a calculation dispute rather than the application of an enhancement to a sentence that had already been resolved.
Well, originally it was a calculation dispute. However, the defense had been disputing it for a long time. John Chapman Holly, who is one of her present lawyers, had been notified by the board, the state parole board, who had notified the judge on the case that they were giving up their claim to the 1 year. So originally, yes, it was a dispute, but it was over.
So what's going to happen now?
They're filing a habeas.
Right.
So what's going to happen now? Right. So some judge will listen to it, and I sincerely hope that they'll come to their senses. I mean, it's outrageous.
Where'd she go back to prison? What prison?
She came from Chowchilla, I think. Uh-huh. It's really awful.
Really underscores the fact that she's a political prisoner, kind of cruelty in what they did to her.
And not only that, the whole bank robbery case, that case had been brought to a grand jury twice, a state grand jury twice, in the late 70s or early 80s. And on two times, the district attorneys of Sacramento County declined to indict. The grand jury heard it. They said,
wow.
The first time they said, we don't think Patricia Hearst is a sufficiently credible witness. We're not going to indict this case. The second time in 2002, and what Heidi said is right, when the word terrorist takes on a different meaning, all of a sudden we have terrorists from the 70s, then they issued the indictment 25 years after the fact. It's a horribly political case, and to do this to her is just so awful.
Where are the Harrises now?
Well, the Harrises did, I think, another 6 or 7 years off behind the bank robbery. They got out at different times, and they're living their lives. Emily has always lived an extremely quiet life. She left prison and has worked. She's a very competent computer programmer. And she's just lived her life for many, many years. And when the bank robbery case came back, all of them basically said, you know, this is a terrible tragedy. These were events we were involved in many, many years ago. There's nothing that can bring the life of this woman back. You know, we just feel awful. And they did. They had moved way beyond the kind of political action and activity that would have brought them to do this.
Sarah Jane Olson's family, are they still in Minnesota?
Yeah.
And she has two children?
Three. She has three of the most wonderful, energetic. I mean, they were teenagers the last time I saw them, so they're 6 or 7 years ago. Yeah, they're very, very solid members of that community. She had an incredible amount of kids, a huge outpouring of community support in Minneapolis. I think they raised something like $1.5 million or $2 million bail over a weekend.
Really?
Yeah. No, the whole family is just beloved. They have a very active center for the victims of torture there, one of the first ones in the country.
Right, that's Doug Johnson's. It's very famous.
And she was very involved in that. She was involved in a leftist bookstore. She was involved in every community activity. I said she went to jail. I've, you know, written her a couple times. I didn't even know she was rearrested because I wasn't watching the news over the weekend, and I called Sean Holly, her lawyer, and I said, oh, please, give me their number. I got to talk to them. And then I don't know who called me and said, it's too late. You can't call her. She's back in. Oh, it's awful. I just feel so much for her.
The current attorneys have filed a request for her to be released since corrections officials, in their opinion, had no authority to rearrest her. Do you know when we might hear about that?
I don't know. I couldn't even get through on the phone the other day. I'll be glad to keep you posted.
Yeah, Susan, is there a website or any organization that our listeners might want to contact to show some political solidarity and support?
I think the only way would be her family.
Well, you know, Susan, the National Lawyers Guild had a defense fund years ago for her, and I think that we need to look into this, and we'll try to post something on our website as well.
This is California's left history. It just goes on and on. I mean, I don't know if you remember Marilyn Buck.
I correspond with her.
I visit Marilyn like once every couple months or something.
Yeah.
In the federal, and she's getting out. She has a date, 2011. And she has turned into such an interesting person. She's gotten two master's degrees.
Wow, I'm very happy to hear that.
She's a published poet. She has a huge following of young poetry students at UC Berkeley. It's a long and old history, and she's just become just a wonderful example.
The only real major criminal trial I ever did was Bell and Bottom, which Herman Bell was my client. He's now in San Francisco facing a murder charge out there after 30, 40 years later.
They're called the San Francisco 8.
Yeah, so I mean, when I think about that, I tried that case in 76.
I know. That's an absolute outrage. It's another outrage. They had no evidence against these guys. And two retired San Francisco cops, I don't know, they found themselves a sinecure in retirement, and they got themselves hired as deputized as special FBI agents or something, and they spent 3 or 4 or 5 years going around the country harassing everyone they could find to get evidence, old evidence. And it's awful.
Yeah, it's a terrible case. I have one last question for you, because I was recently writing a little bio of Margie Ratner Kunstler, who's being honored by the city chapter of the Guild. And I remembered she had an involvement in the so-called Patty Hearst kidnapping case. And I'm trying to remember what it was. There was a guy named Jack Scott.
Yeah.
You remember?
Jack Scott was, he was a sports coach. He got interested in the SLA. But what he also did was, remember the Black Power Salute at the 76 or 77?
Right, he was the coach for those guys, right?
He was the coach behind that.
Right.
But he became interested in the SLA, and he was writing a book about them. And so he met Patty Hearst and Bill and Emily while they were here on the West Coast before they spent a year running, and they ran after the kidnap. And what your listeners may not remember about Patty Hearst was not only was she the newspaper heiress who was kidnapped, but she actually, in a very public video statement, joined the SLA. She renounced her family, she renounced the Hearst empire, and she said, "I'm no longer a kidnap victim. I am joining this group. I like them."
Right.
And she was photographed carrying a machine gun.
It's one of the great photographs, an amazing photograph.
Yeah, and so Jack Scott met her, Bill and Emily. He and his wife volunteered to drive her across country. And so somehow he became a witness, I don't know, somebody, I guess after the fact.
It was a target of a grand jury.
And
I think Margie Kunstler and Bill represented Jack, is what I recall, Jack Scott.
Anyway, there was a grand jury, and he was subpoenaed, and then he died right when Sarah Jane was facing trial in Los Angeles. We wanted to use him as a witness because he told us that when he drove Patty Hearst across country, he said to her, "Look, I'll take you anywhere. I'll take you home. I'll take you to your mother. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to say, you know, you're free. You can go where you want." And she said, "No, I'm going. I'm going underground with these guys. I'm part of this organization," because the government and has always disputed that. They've always said, no, she was a victim of the Stockholm syndrome, and she was a prisoner the whole year that she was underground with them. And Jack Scott was prepared to testify before he died that said to her, "You can go anywhere you want." You know, they're just part of the history of the left of that period.
Well, Susan, really, thank you. It's really interesting
to talk
to you.
Great to hear you.
Living all this.
Okay, bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org. We go now to hear an excerpt from the panel, The Arrival of the American Police State, at the Left Forum 2008, here in New York City. Our own Michael Stevens Smith discusses the juridical and institutional underpinnings of the restrictive American bourgeois democracy before 9/11, and how it has been transformed by the Bush administration into what can most accurately be called a police state. Let's have a listen.
I'm going to speak eventually about the confluence of several crises that are coming to the fore. You know what I'm talking about, especially with respect to the ecology crisis and the economic crisis. And I want to talk about how that plays out with respect to civil liberties. But before I do that, I wanted to share a story with you. We wouldn't be here but for 9/11 and the attacks on the World Trade Center. I live in Battery Park City, a block away from the World Trade Center, and my law office is about this far on the other side of the hole from Ground Zero. So on 9/11, I was supposed to be up having lunch at Windows on the World, you know, that restaurant on top of the building that was hit. And my friend John called me at the last moment. I was supposed to be there at 8 o'clock, and he said, I've got a meeting, I can't come. So I was actually in my apartment bed when the first plane hit, and my wife Debbie said, what was that? I said, you know, it had to be a car accident. What else? And she said, could you go down and take a look? So I went down, and I looked up, and the building was on fire. So I came back, and I reported that. I thought, you know, I better call up John and tell him that if we would have gone to breakfast that day, we wouldn't have got out of there all day. So I'm on the phone with John telling him, and just as I was announcing this mishap with a little plane, the second plane flew right over my apartment. Building shook, and whang, you know. So then Debbie said, we're being attacked. I thought, you know, this is going to change things. In the same way, I remember when John Kennedy was killed, and I thought, I hope it's not a black guy, because this is going to change things too. And, you know, sure enough, the first building came down, and the whole neighborhood turned night, like inside of a closet. Then it kind of lightened up again, and the second building came down, and it turned dark again. And I'm up there with my wife, Debbie, and I've got a big 16-pound gray cat, and I've got a talking parrot, Charlie Parker, because he's a bird. So we thought, well, what are we going to do? We're not portable. So we stayed overnight, and it was untenable. There was no electricity, there was no gas, there was no water, no nothing. So the next day, and the cops came, and they cleared us out. So we left the cat, but we took the bird in his cage, and we started walking up towards Michael Ratner's house in the village, because he and Karen promised that we could stay in the basement and live there. So we're walking up with Charlie in the cage, and the bird is telling everybody we encounter, it's okay, it's okay. But it wasn't okay. And 3 weeks later, the bird starts nodding out and falling off his perch. So we rushed him up to the Animal Medical Center. Only in New York, they've got a veterinarian that specializes in treating avian illness. So we bring him to this doctor. She checks him out, puts in an IV, and she says he's got avian respiratory disease from the schmutz in the air. And I said, all right. And she said, well, I think we can save him, but it'll be $900, please. I said, $900? He was a victim of terrorism. She says, in that case, we've set up a special fund. There's no charge. So they gave him antibiotics. He lived through it. We brought him home. We could never get back into our office because we couldn't get a telephone. So we wound up taking all of our files and putting them on the kitchen table right next to where the bird cage is. We spent a year practicing law next to this talking bird. And I'll come to the point of my story. One morning, Debbie was on the phone with an insurance company adjuster, because we sue insurance companies for injured people. And she's trying to settle a case. And the guy was giving her a hard time. And the bird could pick up on it, because he could hear it. And he started walking back and forth on his perch. He's getting more and more agitated. He's very protective of Debbie, loves Debbie. And finally, he couldn't stand it any longer. And he yelled out in my tone of voice, I'm going to kick your ass. And if you don't remember anything else from what I'm saying, that's what the, in the felicitous term of Gore Vidal, the Bush-Cheney oil and gas junta, has done to us with respect to civil liberties. So I want to talk about what we used to have, what we've got now, and how that, what we've got now, plays out if a pre-revolutionary situation develops in this country because of the confluence of crises that we now see coming into fore. We had what Marxists called bourgeois democracy. It was very limited and restrictive. Initially, of course, because black people weren't whole people, women couldn't vote, there's no economic democracy, but nonetheless, it was an advance over feudalism and what had preceded it. The founding fathers tried to figure out a way to limit executive power. So if you read the Federalist Papers, they have this discussion on how to do it. And they figure they'll set up an executive who's also commander-in-chief, so that's dangerous. So you give Congress the right to declare war. And you have a legislature that passes the laws, not the executive. And you have a judiciary that decides disputes on those laws. And if you have a balance of forces amongst the three tripartite form of government, that'll rein in the executive. Well, that's one of our problems now. The second one is with respect to the Bill of Rights. In 1789, when these discussions were going on about the new Constitution, the people who made the American Revolution, the people with the guns, you know, the farmers and the tradesmen and so on, said, we don't want this Constitution if it doesn't have a Bill of Rights. And the big states particularly pressured them, New York, Massachusetts, Virginia. And the Bill of Rights was passed, and that was made part of the Constitution. And in particular, the First Amendment, which discusses freedom from religion. Remember, a lot of the founding fathers were not Christians. They remembered what kind of oppression happened from a fusion of Christianity and state power in Europe, like the Inquisition, for example. First Amendment also covers freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom to listen. The Second Amendment, right to bear arms. The Fourth Amendment, right to privacy. The Fifth Amendment, due process, right to be treated fairly. The Sixth Amendment, the right to have an attorney. Fifth Amendment in terms of you can't be forced to incriminate yourself, you can't testify against yourself, you're free from torture. All these were discussed and put into the Constitution. Every single one of them is under attack as a result of 9/11. The police state, which had been picking up steam, you could argue, after the United States emerged triumphant in the Second World War, that motion was tremendously accelerated after 9/11. Now, how did it happen? The two keys are, a week after 9/11, on the 18th of September, the authorization to use military force passed by Congress, Republicans and Democrats. Never forget that the Democrats were the handmaidens to this process and facilitated it. And then the military order number one. The government's view is that the attacks of September 11 were part of an act of war and not just a crime. This view is based on the congressional resolution, the authorization for the use of military force, which grants special powers to the executive branch. It stipulates that, this is a quote, this is what it says, the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on 9/11. And Jean-Claude Pay wrote a very good article in Monthly Review in November of 07. And Pay says, the interpretation that the executive makes of this resolution is the expression of a state at war, not against other nations, but against organizations or ordinary individuals that are not linked to a foreign government. This interpretation redefines the concept of war. It gives it an asymmetrical character, a fight to the death between world superpower and persons designated as enemies. Then came the turning point. 2 months later, on the 18th of November, Bush's military order number one. And this was what you might call a coup. Michael Ratner wrote a couple months ago on the anniversary of this law, as he says, I remember thinking to myself that there's just been a coup d'etat in America. Perhaps an exaggeration, but nonetheless a watershed moment in a country that I still thought had some semblance of a democracy and of the principle that presidential authority was under law. As most of you may not recall, the order, let me remind you of its three key provisions. First, the president claimed the authority to capture, kidnap, or otherwise arrest any non-citizen. It was later extended to citizen. Anywhere in the world, including the United States, whom the president believed was involved in international terrorism, and hold them forever without any charges, proceedings, or trial. Amazing. A person could be held forever just because the president wanted them to be held. He took on the power to disappear people. Second, the order did provide that if, and if is the crucial word here, if the person was tried, there was never needed to be a trial, such trials were to be held by special ad hoc courts called military commissions. These commissions had no resemblance to trial courts. The entire proceeding could take place in secret, with evidence from torture, and those found guilty could be executed in secret. Third, to the extent the names of those imprisoned or tried could be determined and lawyers found, no court could hear any case. This order embodies within it the violations of fundamental rights we are facing today: indefinite detention without trial, Guantanamo, secret sites, special trials, and disappearances. While it does not mention torture, that appears to have come a bit later, a secret detention system is part and parcel of a torture system. Let's also repeat, this was a military order in a society and country that was still or purported to be under civilian rule. This order, more than any other single document, embodies our lost liberties. It was this document that pushed the Center for Constitutional Rights into action. Now, what are the elements that made up what my comrade Clark calls rolling coup? Clark was good enough to make a list for all of us, and I'm going to read that for you. The initial seizure of power by Bush when the Supreme Court refused to hold to allow a recount in Florida elections in the year 2000 starts there. Doctrine of global superiority and advocacy of preemptive war in Iraq and maybe now Iran. Remember, Congress has given Bush a carte blanche to launch a war against Iran. Bipartisan. He could do it. He may do it. Repudiation of treaties such as the ABM Treaty, refusal to recognize international law or applicability of the Geneva Accords, the roundup of immigrants after 9/11, people held without charges, domestic deployment of military as law enforcement, the Posse Comitatus Act from 1878 is out the window, establishment of military tribunals at Guantanamo, which I mentioned, secret deportation hearings, seizure of citizens as enemy combatants, effective end of habeas corpus, massive secret wiretaps in violation of the FISA law. That's come up in Congress. Both Obama and Clinton absented themselves from that vote. Issuance of secret administrative warrants of all kinds for records. They can get your government records, they can get your medical records, you don't even know they got them. Suppression of Muslim charities, secret sneak and peek searches so they can come into your office or your house and get whatever they want, and you never know they were there. Classification of most government records. It was the reversal of the idea that the government should be transparent, and if the government is a democracy, it's our government. So whatever records they have, they should give to us. Michael Ratner got the CIA dossier on Che Guevara, and we published it. We could never get that again. Ashcroft said, anybody asks for something, don't give it to them, and we'll defend you. Legitimization of torture. Special rendition, that's outsourcing torture. Establishment of privatized military contractors, like Khaki or Blackwater. You know, they had Blackwater patrolling the streets after they lost New Orleans. Assertion of executive supremacy through signing statements. Heidi's an expert on that if you want to ask her about it, but the long and the short of it is Bush has issued more signing statements saying he's going to ignore laws that are passed by Congress than all the other presidents of America combined. expanded use of recess appointments, doctrine of unitary executive. The $385 million, this is icing on their cake. Kellogg Brown and Root, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton, got $385 million to set up a huge detention camp, and they said it's not just for immigrants. So, well, what to do? How does this affect what may happen politically in the future? Imagine with me, if you will, the development of a pre-revolutionary situation in this country. Let's say there was another ecological disaster, say Atlanta runs out of water, which it almost did a few months ago. Or let's say that all the nuclear weapons floating around the world, somebody gets their hands on one and detonates it, and there's a cloud that's drifting our way. Or let's say they attack Iran. Or let's say the recession that we're in, which is going to be very deep and very long, let's say it sprouts into a genuine depression and that there are tens of millions of people that are unemployed. That could very well happen. They've borrowed $3 million, mostly from the Chinese and from the Japanese, to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's playing havoc with the economy. The Chinese and the Japanese don't want to call the loans back because they don't want to bring down the United States, because they want the United States to buy the stuff they manufacture. But it's all very tricky. There could very likely be an economic crisis. You get the idea. So, you know, things could get worse. And things getting worse don't put people into motion. Putting people into motion is they have some hopes that they can make things better. But let's say people do get into motion. Let's say, like during 1968, some of us remember that the anti-war movement was so well organized and so strong and so disgusted with Nixon when he bombed Cambodia, we shut down hundreds of campuses across the country and we opened them up as anti-war universities. And we had a huge demonstration in Washington. What if we have committees, anti-war committees, and we have ecology committees, and we've got fighting the depression committees? And what if they all get together? What if they start, you know, making demands on the government, like they're going to have a huge march on Washington, or they demand that the government give jobs to everybody at union wages, or they say that people working 40 hours should only work 30 hours so that the extra work can be spread out? I mean, you get the idea. What if a movement starts up like that? What if there's a general strike? Like in 1968, there was a general strike in France that the students triggered off. If it wasn't for the misleadership of the French Communist Party, there would have been a socialist France. De Gaulle was so convinced that they could lose there that he went to Belgium and he hid out. So what if there's a convergence of what we had in 68 and we have it here? Well, that's why I think, and Clark is going to give you a broader perspective historically on this, but that's why I think that they've done to the Constitution what they've done, because they know that they're going to need these tools to hold on to power. And we should understand that. We should understand that to the marrow of our bones. What do we need to do about it? Just what we're doing now. Educate ourselves, organize, join a group. Find a group out there that you most agree with and join it. If you don't agree with any group out there, form your own group. But get organized. And remember what Frederick Douglass told us, that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never will and never has. So that's what we have to do. I remember when we took over Wayne State University campus and the student newspaper, black anarcho-syndicalist group called the Dodge Revolutionary Movement, DRUM, in Detroit, had a slogan. And that slogan was on the campus newspaper, and it said, "Dare to struggle, dare to win." And that's what we should do. Thanks.
That was Michael Stephen Smith at the Left Forum on the panel, The Arrival of the American Police State. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
of our war against the American people, we're mounting a sustained campaign to crack down on every American and every person of every faith and every nation, and to bring them to justice. All missions are being executed according to plan, without warning or provocation. Americans are being swept up in an international dragnet. Thousands of FBI agents are on the trail of other citizens here and abroad. It has everything to do with hate and evil and murder and prejudice. America's strong, strong, strong.
Federal agents, we are armed! What would you do if you knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk away? What would you do if you knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk away?
I see a message from the government. Like every day, I watch it and listen and call them all suckers. They wanted me about Osama or whatever. Picture me buying the scam, I said never. You in tune to a hard truth soldier spitting. I stay committed, gives a f*** to die, I lose commission. It's all a part of fighting devil state mind control. And all about the battle for your body, mind, and soul. And now I'm hoping you don't close your mind so they shape you. Don't forget they made us slaves, gave us AIDS and raped us. Another Bush season mean another war for profit. All in secret so the public never think to stop it. The Illuminati, 666, all connected. Stole the votes, they control the race and take elections. It's the Skull and Bones Freemason Kill Committee. See the dragon get deer in every city.
What would you do if you,
what would you do?
Knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk away?
Now ask yourself, who's the one with the most to gain? 4-9-11, mother couldn't stand his name. Now even waving flags like they lost their mind. Everybody got opinions but don't know the time. Cause America's been took, it's plain to see. The oldest trick in the book is making enemy. A phony evil so the government can do its dirt and take away your freedom, lock and load, beat and search. Ain't nothing changed but more colored people locked in prison. These pigs still beat us but it seems we forgetting. But I remember 4 September how these devils do it. Giuliani asked Diallo how he doing. We in the streets, holler jail to the thief. Follow waving flags, bring these dragons to their knees. Oil, blood, money, make these killers ride cold. Suspicious suicide, people dying never told. It's all a part of playing God, so you think we need them. While being Ashcroft, take away your rights to freedom. Bear witness to the sickness of these dictators. Hope you understand the time, brother, cause it's major.
What would you do if you knew all the things we knew?
Why my records always come the same? Keep it real, ain't no fillers, mother blinging. Mine eyes seen the gory of the coming of the beast. So every story, every word I'm saying.